This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When it comes to art, the narrative of how a piece is created can add value and importance to the work itself. Take Jackson Pollock's seminal 1943 painting, Mural.
The painting is about 8 feet tall and 20 feet wide. It's the scale of a mural, which is why it's called Mural, the scale of a wall. Pollock described the painting as being like a Mustang stampede in the Wild West.
That's LA Times art critic Christopher Knight. He wrote about Mural, which wrapped up a nearly two-year restoration this month. The conservation project allows viewers to see the work as though it was painted just yesterday.
If you look closely, you can see suggestions of figures and perhaps suggestions of horses' heads, and it's painted in yellows and blacks and teals and browns and reds, and it's a very vigorous, thickly painted canvas.
How important is this painting in terms of art history or Jackson's contribution to art history?
This is a really pivotal painting in the development of the New York School after World War II. It's really the first painting that takes abstraction, which is essentially a European phenomenon, and puts it into a really American context.
Knight explains that a big part of the mystique surrounding Mural stems from its origin story, a myth propagated by Pollock's wife, the painter Lee Krasner, and art collector and dealer Peggy Guggenheim. It was also portrayed in the biopic Pollock, starring Ed Harris.
The thing that interests me is that today, painters do not have to go to a subject matter outside of themselves. They work from a different source. They work from within.
It is a myth that confirms our romantic notions of art and inspiration as powerful, fleeting, and vigorous.
Well, the standard story about the creation of the painting was that Peggy Guggenheim, the collector and art dealer in New York, had, in the summer of 1943, commissioned the mural for the entry hall of her apartment in Manhattan on East 61st Street, and that Pollock was excited about the prospect of doing the painting. So he stretched the canvas in his studio. He took down a wall in his apartment because he didn't have enough space. Took down a wall, stretched the canvas, and there the canvas sat for months and months and months because he was stuck. He was frozen. He was intimidated. He was scared. He didn't know what to do. And then at some point around Christmas, Peggy Guggenheim had it waiting for this painting and put her foot down. And on one night after sundown, Pollock picked up his brush, and over the course of the next 15 hours, in a frenzy of activity, painted the entire painting that we know today. That's the creation myth, and it is a myth. It didn't really happen that way.
Well, what did happen?
Well, the conservation team at the J. Paul Getty Museum and the Getty Conservation Institute have been spending almost the last 2 years working on the painting. And one of the things they did was analyze the paints that Pollock used. They've identified about 25 different paints. Many of them are high-quality oil paints. Some of them had been thinned. There is also white house paint, which is not something they expected to find. At any rate, all of these different paints have different drying times. So through spectrography and X-ray and so on, the conservators were able to discern that different layers of paint were not blended, were not merged, which meant that one layer had to dry before another layer was put on. So the painting could not have been made in one 15-hour sitting. It required several days, perhaps even several weeks, to execute the painting.
So what's behind this myth? Why create it? Or maybe we should just call it a lie.
Well, one thing that I should explain is that the myth seems to have been built on a foundation of partial truth. It seems that the overall composition of the picture may well have been done in one sitting, and then the painting was adjusted over the course of several days or several weeks. My speculation on this origin myth has to do with the time in which it was made. Remember, 1943 is deep into World War II. Mm-hmm. Jackson Pollock was 31 years old, and he was not in uniform, not serving in Europe or in the Pacific during the war. There was a great deal of gossip and speculation about his sexual identity, that perhaps he was a repressed homosexual. His girlfriend, Lee Krasner, later his wife, was well aware of all of this. And I think that this whole myth of a virile, heroic exertion of effort to create this breakthrough masterpiece served to bolster Pollock's reputation at the time, at the given time. And once that myth began to be repeated, it really took root.
As an art critic, Christopher, how do you process a revelation like this? Does it diminish the importance of mural in your eyes?
For me, it does just the opposite. Part of this myth has suggested that what artists do is, in creative bursts of sheer genius, spew forth masterpieces, which, of course, is not really how art actually gets made. What it suggests to me is that Pollock was, in fact, much more skillful. He knew what he was doing. He was developing his own aesthetic. He started the picture, he went back, he adjusted things, he modified things until he was satisfied with the result. Rather than undermining his reputation, to me it enhances his reputation as a serious painter.
Christopher Knight, LA Times art critic, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, my pleasure.
You'll find a link to read Christopher's article about the refurbished Pollock painting mural and the death of its heroic origins myth. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Picture this, a woman and her husband and daughter, all neatly dressed and coiffed in front of the Eiffel Tower and other Parisian landmarks. The woman is smiling emphatically. The husband and daughter remain expressionless. In fact, they are mannequins, props, dressed up and posed in photographs projecting family togetherness. The family quins, as they are called, appear in a series of vacation snaps, holiday dinner photos, and Christmas cards for a series called Life Once Removed by the photographer and artist Suzanne Heintz. Heintz says it's about spinsterhood in the American way, and her work is the subject of an upcoming feature film called Playing House. Suzanne Heintz, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
I am really curious about what got this project off the ground.
Isn't everyone? What started this? Well, it was the pressure to conform. You know, no matter where I turned, I got the question, why aren't you married? You're so cute. You're so fun. I can't understand why you don't have a man. And I just got tired of hearing that. And, you know, one day even my own mother put the question to me, Susie, you know, nobody's perfect out there. You're just going to have to pick somebody if you want to settle down. And that really just hit a trigger with me, and I yelled back at her. And I said, Mom, you know, this is fate we're talking about. It's not like I can go out and make this happen. I can't go out and buy a family. So that just kind of sat with me for a while. And you know, weeks later, I was walking past a retail liquidation outlet center, and I saw these mannequins in the window, and it looked like a perfect family. And I was like, I can go out and buy a family, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. So I decided to start a photo series on just that subject.
Tell me about some of these situations and poses that you put your family members, which seem to consist mostly of a very handsome man and a young daughter, maybe 10, 12 years old.
Yeah. Actually, she's perpetually 8 years old. But, I put them in precarious situations that you really ought not put delicate fiberglass mannequins in. However, you know, I've taken them skiing and I've taken them to Yellowstone and Paris and skating on frozen lakes. I do everything you really shouldn't do with mannequins.
Do they have a backstory? Do they have names? I mean, how deeply?
Well, actually, they do have names. My husband is named Chauncey, and I have a seated version and a standing version. So his name is Chauncey A and Chauncey B. I do have a daughter, and her name is Mary Margaret. Just sounded like the perfect name for a redheaded, freckled girl.
Well, the poses that you put them in, the colors that you're wearing, the fashions all look to be of a certain era, you know, this idealized period of the homemaker. Tell us a little bit about the choices to use that vintage of family life.
Right. I stylize the images to reflect the area of the ideal nuclear family because it's essential to my message. What I'm communicating when I wear vintage clothing is that even in the 21st century, the image of how our lives should look has got its feet firmly planted in the last century. I mean, why haven't we moved on? Traditional lifestyles like that of, you know, Ozzie and Harriet are no longer relevant, yet we stubbornly still cling to that ideal.
Why did you choose to use yourself as a model instead of having someone else in there? What's your role inside of this?
Well, I couldn't have hired anyone to play me. This is all about me. And I, you know, I'm using myself as an instrument to relate a bigger, what would you call it? I mean, it's been termed a free-floating anxiety. You know, the angst that we all feel that nobody's really got their finger on it. You know, we are all somehow subject to expectations that aren't our own. Even if you are married, you get the question, where's the grandkids? Hmm. Or, you know, say it's in relation to your career. Oh, that's great. You're an attorney. Well, why aren't you partner? We're always focusing on the next step and never really focusing on how good we are in the present moment.
I'd love to know what's going through your head as you pose. I mean, it's like we've seen these kinds of poses so many times. The woman, you know, pulling the family along in the toboggan. You know, you always look ecstatically happy. And your familykins, they look sort of blank. They're just props. Now that so many people are projecting their lives out on Facebook and showing who they are and what an exciting life they have, it's almost like everybody else is incidental. They're almost like props.
Yes. That is very true. I mean, image crafting has a whole lot to do with this subject. I mean, all of my work has to deal with image versus reality. And I think, you know, because I'm projecting this over-the-top gleam of happiness, I think that speaks to exactly what you're talking about with Facebook. Facebook is today's postcard. Mm-hmm. And we used to send postcards to people to sort of brag about, look at me, I'm in Paris, you're at home. But we now are, I think, losing ourselves in image projection and making our lives look a little more than they really are. I think it's absolutely essential that we start tapping into not just the image of what a successful life looks like, but the feeling of contentment it's supposed to reflect. You know, we're losing contact with our internal selves, and we're just constantly focusing on how it looks to other people. I think that's the wrong way to go in order to live a happy life.
We're speaking with the artist Suzanne Heintz, who has put together a series of photographs called Life Once Removed. It's her in several different situations with her sort of fake mannequin family that she purchased to set up as props around her as she takes exciting pictures of her absolutely full and fulfilling looking life. Talk to me a little bit about the logistics of traveling with a mannequin family.
Oh, you have no idea what it's like traveling with a family of mute quadriplegics. they were very difficult to get around. I'd never been abroad before with them, and I didn't realize how difficult it would be to just get them places. I'd always had a car. So I relied on, you know, the kindness of strangers and friends to help me get them around. But there were some times when I just had to go on my own. Well, no cab driver wanted to take me anywhere, so I oftentimes had to either strap them to a hand truck or carry them on my shoulders, which was actually very funny, and it was a great way to, you know, just walk through the streets and gain people's attention, and I got to talk to them and explain what the heck I was doing.
Well, we see in some of the photographs, you can see the reactions of others who are looking at you. There's one, it looks as if you were at either a ballroom dance class or an actual dance, you know, your husband mannequin is wearing a white dinner jacket. You've got a beautiful strapless gown on. And a woman is kind of looking at you. I'm wondering what people say to you when they see you posing with your mannequin family.
Well, I get one of two reactions. Either they raise their eyebrows and walk away, or they laugh hysterically and have to ask what I'm doing. So especially in that scenario, that was at a Valentine's Day ball at a local ballroom here. And there were quite a few people there that were just enthralled with the project and actually tried to cut in and and dance with me and leave Chauncey on the side. So, I mean, it's a really, what would you call it? People are charmed by it when they see this happening. I mean, really, how can you hold a straight face when you see a woman dancing with a mannequin?
But when they ask you, why are you doing this, what do you tell them? Do you have a sort of elevator pitch answer kind of thing?
Oh, I do, actually. I said, my mom was pressuring me to get married, so this is what happens when you force the situation.
Well, now that you've got a little distance, I mean, I am also a woman who's not married, doesn't have children, and I understand what you mean. You know, we choose a life, but there's a little sting of you're not quite normal if this is how you're living your life.
Right.
Did it take you doing this project to overcome that? Has it been cathartic for you to consider yourself in all these fantasy situations when you realize that, probably like a lot of women, you're lugging your family around?
Yeah, actually it is just like that. It is very cathartic. I come from a fairly large family, and we were raised Mormon to boot. And, you know, it was just something I expected to happen in my life. You know, I just sort of assumed that I'd get married with kids. You know, I could have gotten married when I was young, and I didn't. There have been moments in my life where I asked myself, wow, you know, I am not going to have a family when I'm older. Am I okay with that? But as I've sort of acted out this entire scenario over a 14-year period of time, I realized that I do have a family. I just don't have any children of my own. You know, I have a loving companion, yet I don't call him a husband. You know, I have the love and appreciation of my family, as well as the only kind of family that you can choose, friends. You know, when I was young, I assumed that my life would look like everyone else's because that's just what you do. But as I grew up, I found that I had a choice in the matter. I feel as though that this project has actually been the culmination of my life, and I am grateful for this experience. I have never had so much direct impact on so many people's lives. I mean, if I had had my own family, I would probably have had this much impact on four people's lives. But now, people in China care what I have to say. And people in Bolivia are writing me about how I've touched their lives and how I've changed their perspective of themselves and their whole life. To me, that's the purpose in living, is to make an impact.
Well, you certainly did it here, Suzanne Hines. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Suzanne Hines, the photographer and artist behind Life Once Removed. You can look through a series of some of these photographs for yourself and watch short film clips about her process and setups. Those short chapters of film are eventually going to be a feature film called Playing House. All of that at wordofmouthradio.org.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away.
Whether you love it or you hate it, at some point we have all had to sing Happy Birthday. When Word of Mouth continues, a journalist becomes an activist for abolishing the song all together.
Fly away. Come fly with me, let's float down